Our friends Ricky and Callie from Groenfell Meadery are launching a new mead, Bright Eyed. It's blueberry coffee mead with maple, vanilla, and cinnamon. That's blueberry coffee mead with maple, vanilla, and cinnamon. It sounds like breakfast. And for a limited time, Groenfell is going to have bright-eyed coffee mugs so you can enjoy your mead on an early morning Zoom call. That may or may not be a good idea. Use your own judgment. Groenfell is now shipping bright-eyed and their other delicious craft meads, along with Havoc meads, all across the country. Check them out at family-owned and operated Groenfell.com. That's Groenfell. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, January 14th, 2021. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, I visit with Grant Hewer, Lucas Greta, and Betsy Duffy of Hazelig Brewing in Newton, Iowa. The fledgling brewery made a big showing at the GABF and the San Diego Beer Festival, where they took Champion Brewery. We'll hear background on some of their award-winning beers. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. And if you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs and our brewer's logbooks. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. I want to start the show off this week on a serious note. If you listened to last week's show, there was no mention of the horrific event taking place at our nation's capital. I had already produced the episode and put it on the server when the attack began. Susan and I watched the live coverage. I felt anger, disgust, and frankly, I felt physically ill. I contemplated not posting the show at all to the feeds, but decided to go ahead and do it, not calling attention to it on social media. I frankly felt overwhelmed and almost paralyzed to do anything else. Now, a week later, I still feel that same disgust and anger. However, I don't want to transfer that to the show. I do want you to know in the present and if you're listening to the archives that I didn't purposefully ignore the attack. It was just a matter of timing. I don't plan to make this show a political platform in any way. Just know that I'm aware. There's no easy way to transition from that. Let's just take a breath for just a second. There's good news on the sampler series front. First of all, Marcus from Sweden very generously sent three rare Swedish hops for use in our hop sampler. And he sent enough that I'm planning to brew something for the video show, too. He sent, and I'm probably not going to pronounce these correctly, Hulla Norgard, which sounds like a film noir actress, Korsta, and Svalof Moritz. One wrinkle is the third one was a whole flower, not pellets. So this will be the first hop sampler to feature a small batch brewed with whole hops. Also, Sugar Creek Malts in Indiana very generously sent me seven different malts to play with. They're Crystal 40, Lambic Wind Malt, Pilsner, Bourbon Barrel Aged Chocolate Malt, Crystal Rye, Lavender Smoke, and Rausch Malt. I'm extremely excited to use these in a malt sampler, and I have some ideas for some full batches for the video show and for my keg. I plan to have Sugar Creek on the show in the near future, and again, I'm grateful to them for sending so much stuff. And listener Danzy proposed we do a water sampler. Knowing my ignorance of water chemistry, Danzy did the calculations for me to come up with water profiles for balanced, bitter, and malty small batches, so I'm also excited about that. We got a lot of fun things coming down the line, and I'm very grateful to everybody who contributes to the show, whether it's sending ideas, sending ingredients, or just sending a note to say that you're out there and that you're doing okay. I also greatly appreciate our sponsors, like our friends at Imperial Organic Yeast. Now that's a transition I can make with no problem at all. Imperial Yeast is expanding to the East Coast. Phase one of opening will include shipping their four guaranteed in-stock strains, A38 Juice, AO7 Flagship, L13 Global, and GO3 Dieter to commercial customers. Production build-out is underway, and they hope to offer their full lineup as well as homebrew pouches mid-2021, which is just around the corner. You know, when I first interviewed the folks from Imperial on this show, I asked Owen what his goals were for his company, and he said it was to become the biggest yeast supplier. And I'm embarrassed now that I think I laughed, but he was serious. And with the quality of the product coming out of Imperial Organic Yeast, you know they're serious. Imperial has the highest pitch rate at 200 billion cells per easy-to-open package. My stir plate is dusty because I don't make starters anymore for moderate gravity 5-gallon batches. And if I pitch in the afternoon, my airlocks are usually bubbling before bedtime. Ask your local homebrew store about Imperial Organic Yeast and check them out at imperialyeast.com. I have to thank Glenn Cole for recommending that I talk to Grant Heuer and the folks at Hazelig. Hazelig Brewing in Newton, Iowa has only been open for a short period of time, but they've come out of the gates fast, taking multiple awards and the attention of the craft beer world. Grant Heuer, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thanks for having me.
You've chosen to share the spotlight today with somebody. Who have you got with you?
I've got my good buddy, Lucas Greta. Other titles include brewer and keeper of my sanity.
Welcome, Lucas.
Thank you. Yep, appreciate being here.
Well, I got to say, I started, first of all, I have to thank Glenn Cole, past guest on this show, for recommending you. And then when I got to reading about your brewery, Gazelle Brewing, and I assume I'm pronouncing that right.
It is. So it's a Dutch word, and it kind of loosely translates to that warm feeling of that you get when you're with friends or loved ones. So as a limited Dutch speaker at this point, I would say gezellig.
Oh.
But I think the crossover to English is kind of hazelig. So, but then, then that kind of like skirts with the, so it kind of becomes more kind of like hazelig would be a lot of the way a lot of people would say it. I feel like it's always a rabbit hole for me to talk about the pronunciation.
Well, I would say, you might have some branding issues, but with the record that y'all have tallied up in just the past year, I would say that people will learn how to pronounce your name. But as I was saying, I started to research your brewing and your brewery and your short history there in Iowa. It's impressive, and I'm not sure where to start. Grant, you have a background. You were educated in the Netherlands, and you were a former poker player, as I understand it. How did you get into brewing?
Well, I guess those two were kind of related. I was actually living in Austin, Texas at the time, and getting really into the craft beer scene there. So I was, paying the bills with poker, with online poker, and that meant, that my weekends were very busy, beating drunks out of their money online. But my earlier in the week, I had a lot of time and had a lot of disposable income. So, I had a friend get me into brewing, and just the next thing I knew, I was doing 4 batches at once on my stove, and kind of didn't look back from there.
Wow. And how did you get into the professional world?
Well, the U.S. Justice Department was very helpful with that. When they took down the online poker sites, I knew I wanted to do kind of my own thing, or I felt like when I moved back from Europe to the United States, we didn't have work-life balance quite as well figured out here, so I wanted to make sure that I did something for a living that I was passionate about, and it just so happened that I had, wholeheartedly caught the brewing bug, so... I joked with people early on in my career that I went from the easiest money I'd ever made, sort of in my underwear drinking green tea, to some of the hardest money I've ever made.
And you started out at the bottom. You didn't start out with a formal education in brewing. You started out cleaning kegs, basically?
pretty much. I actually got my start in Laughlin, Nevada, at a little brew pub, and I was an unpaid intern for about a month, and driving about 3.5 hours round trip from Vegas every day for that. But yeah, I was just truly, truly from the bottom. I had gone and gotten my certified Cicerone just to try to have something on my resume other than poker and a business degree at the time.
So there was some formal education.
Oh, brewing-wise, no, not at all. Other than the Brewing Network and whatever I could get my hands on, books-wise and everything. But yeah, I'm very much self-taught formally.
And you were in Southern California, is that right?
That's where I was living last. Yes, it's Temecula, California, and I was brewing in Carlsbad, California.
And how did you? What drew you to Iowa?
Well, other than Iowa is like the obvious choice to go from Southern California. my folks are originally from Durant, Iowa, which is about 90 miles east of here.
Okay. All right.
So it was, and I have family in Missouri, family in Chicago. So I was hoping to get back closer to home and to family, and was a little tired of the cost of living in California.
Mm.
It's been a fun move.
And Lucas, how long have you known Grant? And talk about your background in brewing as well.
Yeah, sure. I've known Grant since he pretty much moved to Iowa to start working at Tezelig. I'm actually I grew up in Newton, and so I oddly enough lived in Southern California around the same time as Grant, but we kind of just passed each other like ships in the night. And I recently moved back to Iowa as well, and got my start at a few breweries in Des Moines. But once Hazelig opened up in Newton, the brewery that I was working at the time, we knew we wanted to do a collaboration with Grant, considering I'm, like I said, it'd be like returning to my hometown to do that. So ever since we did a couple of collaborations, I think we've been pretty good friends ever since then. And just the way things worked out, I had an opportunity to come work here with him, and I think we both kind of jumped at the chance to do that. So I'd say things have worked out pretty well.
And the brewery has not been open very long.
No, I think we started brewing late April of 2019, I want to say. And our owner Beth shaking her head at me that that sounds right.
Yeah. Well,
our tasting room opened early June of 2019. So yeah, we're still young bucks in the game here.
Well, I want to talk about your owners, Betsy Duffy and Mindy Vanden Bosch, if I've got that part of my research correct. Is Betsy? You just say Betsy is within earshot?
She is. Yes.
Well, can we talk to Betsy? I feel like I'm on a séance. You don't have to, Betsy. It's okay.
Oh, no, she's heading this way.
Well, I wonder.
Seems to be as quiet as possible in the background.
Well, you don't have to be quiet. More input is good. Betsy, you and your financial partner Mindy are co-owners of the brewery. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And you're in the minority. There aren't too many women owners of breweries in the United States, right?
That is a fact.
So, how did it start? How did this all get going?
Well, so Mindy and I both live in a small town that's just about a half hour from Newton. And in that small town is, we were actually approached about the cool factor of having a brewery in that town. And Mindy and I both thought that, yes, it was absolutely a really fun and great idea, and I have a many-year background in beer and craft beer. So we partnered up and worked on that, and while that location did not work out, Newton happened to work out absolutely fantastically.
Nice. And you, I mean, your first year, we're going to talk about all the awards and all the success. But you've got to be blown away by the success of the beers and the success of your brewers in this first short time period.
Well, we really owe it all to the brewers. They are absolutely some of the, not only most talented, but some of the best-hearted people that I have ever known. And we're pretty blessed.
Well, congratulations.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, our audience is homebrewers and people who want to know all the secrets to brewing the beers. So first of all, let's talk about the awards. At GABF, two silver medals, and then at the San Diego International Beer Competition, not only was there a collection of like four or five medals, including two gold, a bronze, a silver, but the championship brewery. So Grant gets to come to Iowa and help start up a brewery, and then goes back to Southern California to really to show them up. What was that like?
That was pretty surreal for me, honestly. When I came aboard, I said, "Hey, I would really love if we could enter, you know, the San Diego International Beer Festival." At least the first year that I'm here, just, you know, kind of for bragging rights, you know, if I could show up some of my old friends and colleagues. You know, I kind of said, hey, I want to go do some damage there. I didn't mean win the whole thing. we were pretty stoked. And obviously, coming from that area, I think they probably still have about 150 breweries just in San Diego County. And it's a lot of guys making great beer there, and they can all drive their entries right up and turn them into the contest. So we were really honored to perform so well there.
Yeah, I was reading down the list of the awards. You know, we're talking Stone, we're talking Firestone Walker, you know, Pizza Port. You know, it's just the laundry list of well-known, you know, excellent breweries. And you just kind of took them to task. You really did a good job. So congratulations on that as well.
Yeah. Hey, we're don't ask us to do it again.
Yeah. Yeah. You peaked really early. So talk about, first of all, let's talk about your equipment. What are you brewing on? What kind of a brewery system do you have there?
We have a 10 barrel from ABE. I believe that's American Beverage Equipment, I want to say. So we have a 10 barrel system, and then four 20 barrel fermenters and one 20 barrel Bright. So we're still little guys from the pro perspective.
Mm-hmm. What would you say is the brewing philosophy there?
A lot of days it's we've never brewed this beer before, so we can't screw it up. I guess another loose philosophy I try to get us to abide by is we try to take the beer seriously, but not ourselves.
And the names of some of these beers kind of indicate that. It seems like y'all are having fun.
We're, you know, anybody that's been around a brewery, there's a lot of no fun days. So the naming and the winning awards, those are the fun days.
Well, let's talk about some of these beers. I wanted you to talk about and Lucas, feel free to, and Betsy, feel free to jump in there as well. Let's talk about some of these beers, the character of the beers, and then what goes into making them so good.
Sure.
One that won gold in San Diego was the Double Rog Dare You. So talk about that beer.
So that beer was kind of dreamt up when Lucas was first going to come on board with us, and I was just sort of throwing out crazy ideas, and the GABF and the San Diego International Beer Festival had both opened up to 10 entries, so we could kind of play around a little more, and that was, I suggested Double Rogan beer, and he kind of gave me the USOB I'm in response to that, so from there we sort of went down the path of what turned out to be just an utterly hellacious brew day.
If I had known then what I know now, I would have never allowed us to brew that beer. But two gold medals later, you know, everything kind of worked out. So
now this is a big old beer with a lot of rye, right?
think we're somewhere in the 40 to 45% range with that. We're about 2-to-1 Weyermann rye malt to just flake rye.
Wow.
I really actually wanted to work some crisp rye in there because the Weyermann, I think, is like, it's in the low threes as far as the level bond's concerned, and the crisp runs like 7-to-12. So normally in like a rye IPA, I prefer the Weyermann that's got a little lower level bond, but I actually wanted to work some of the crisp in that had a little more of the bready. It has kind of a, you know, obviously being malted more, it's got a little more kind of rye bread character to it, I would say, but it just so happened that the BSG, our supplier, was out of the crisp, so we just had to go win gold medals with just the rye, or just with the Weyermann. So it's really, you know, I don't know if that was fate or if that's how we're going to take the double roggen beer to the next level next time, if there's ever a next time. But
no,
on our system, that much rye is very much very, very gummy, very difficult to deal with.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've done some 100% rye beers with brew in a bag. And if, you know, when I tried to brew with just what I thought was just a normal gravity beer, the final product turned out to taste like, you know, Vic's Formula 44D with hops, you know, very, very thick. So what was your strategy on that? How did you deal with that?
Well, our strategy, I wouldn't recommend it for most people because, we ended up kind of flying by the seat of our pants. The day of, we got everything milled in, and our auger decided that instead of working as intended, it would start spooling out backwards and basically spilling all of our milled grain directly underneath the grist case instead of depositing it into the mash tun. So our first step on that brew day was actually to go buy a brand new shop vac and some trash cans and vacuum out about 600 pounds of grain so that we could fix the auger. So the grain got a little bit more beat up than expected, which probably did not help our gumminess issue once we actually got it back into the mash tun eventually. But our strategy, whatever strategy we may have had, kind of went out the window almost immediately that brew day. So,
If I was giving advice to homebrewers brewing double roggen beer, I would say be brewing. If you're not brewing a bag, you're brewing a bag that day. You need your rubber mallet just to beat the word out of the grain.
And did you use rice hulls or anything else like that to kind of help with that process?
I think we tried to. That might have been part of a problem,
we
too.
We did. I think we had for the first time ever, I think Grant had a brewing friend who suggested that maybe if you laid down a bed of rice hulls first, or in like the sort of the first wave of the grain that hits the mash tun, that would somehow be beneficial. But in our experience, after we were able to mash out and kind of get a look at the screens on our mash tun, basically what happened was all the rice hulls just lodged in place and clogged everything. So that might have actually contributed to some of our hellacious day.
He's a brewing acquaintance now. He's no longer a friend.
Yeah, we've cut him out.
And how was the character of the first of all, what was the finishing gravity of the beer, and then what how was the character of the beer?
I think we came in the low nine as far as ABV, pretty chewy. I mean, like you said, you know, the mouthfeel. I mean, if you get the rye, you get rye above 30% pretty much, and the mouthfeel is just like nuts. Yeah, off the top of my head, if I had to guess, it probably started at like, I want to say 21 Play-Doh and finished out around 4 or 5 would be off the top of my head. Feel free, anybody, to email for further further information on a beer. I'm not sure we could ever recreate, and we're not sure we want to tell you to do that either. But one of the big tricks I would say with brewing that beer, I felt like, and brewing any of the any Hef beer, is that that Weihenstephaner strain, and we use the Omega Hefeweizen 1. We actually like to run that at 62 degrees and ramp that up to about 66, 67. And we find that that really kind of helps blow out a lot of that, gets you a really nice balance of the vanilla banana kind of clove thing. So and that's credit Jamil Zainashev for that approach.
There you go. And a lot of times when people brew with rye, I haven't found it so much, you know, with my 100% rye session beers, you know, that I put a lot of hops in. But a lot of people say that brewing with rye gives you a spicy character. You know, I guess if pairing with, you know, a spicy yeast, it might be hard to tell what the rye is bringing to it. But did you get a lot of spice with the with that malt?
I always feel like that that descriptor is just off, you know. I mean, you know, if I could give a tip for, say, trying to win with a rye IPA in any contest is maybe put a slightly spicy hop in. But, again, once you've gone full Roggenbier, it's certainly hard to, you know, any light spice notes you're going to get from the rye are probably overshadowed by all your clove and, you know, just, I mean, that yeast is very, very expressive when you run it, you know, started at 62, you know, contrary to what all the advice may tell you, there's just a ton of esters and phenols, so it would be hard. I need to get to the next level of Cicerone to truly tell you what's what there. But especially the flake dry, I feel like I get a little more of that kind of like, there's almost kind of like baseball card pack bubble gum a little bit, like that stale bubble gum a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the bigger notes I can always pick out by sneaking a little bit of flake dry into something.
Huh. Yeah, I don't get the spice. You know, it's not like it's a rye bread, you know, may have, you know, some spiciness to it. But, the you know, in my experience with those beers that I've been brewing with a ton of rye in it, you know, I just don't get that spice character. So
I think, like, you know, I'd sneak it in like a West Coast for, you know, like 3 to 5%, just rye malt. And I always kind of describe it as it keeps the back end from being too clean. You know, it's got like a dirty, almost like just a dirty, earthy, a little mouthfeel. Especially if you're going to use pretty dank hops, it just kind of puts a stank on things. But I like, as I would describe it. But yeah, I've never really gotten a ton of spice out of rye.
Let's take a quick break to talk about our friends and sponsors at High Gravity in Tulsa. Desiree and Dave, you know highgravitybrew.com is the place to find excellent Warthog electric brewing systems built by Dave himself. I've had mine for several years, and it has certainly taken the pain out of propane. And highgravitybrew.com is also the place for you to find all the ingredients that you need for your next delicious batch of beer. Their Build Your Own Beer page makes it really easy to put together your next recipe. The entire contents of a well-stocked homebrew shop is right there in front of you on one page. As you scroll down and add malts, hops, yeasts, flavorings, anything you need, the total for your order remains at the bottom of the browser window, keeping you updated as you shop. And if you want to use a tried and tested recipe, check out the ingredient kits at highgravitybrew.com. Whether you're all grain or extract, you can find a wide assortment of kits that have been vetted by the patrons at Pippin's Tap Room there at High Gravity. You know we love Desiree and Dave. Drop on by and tell them we sent you. Family-owned and operated, highgravitybrew.com. That's highgravitybrew.com. All the Goodness is a fruit beer that won not only gold at San Diego, but silver at GABF. Talk about that beer.
That's kind of a cool beer. You know, from a contest perspective, I've had luck before with a sour with passion fruit and pineapple. It's kind of, other than having to order all that really expensive fruit puree, so that's kind of an automatic, you know, going to have you in the top 25% of the field in fruit beers. we just kind of played with a pretty light Saison base, just a little bit of rye malt, a little bit of flaked oats. Used Saison Stein's Monster from Omega. It's kind of an interesting, where they've made a genetic hybrid of Belgian and French Saison yeast. And then I was just trying to find something to kind of put a spin on it, and especially, you know, sort of in Belgian fruited beers, I personally find, you know, fruit works so much better in a sour than, you know, it just comes up, you know, something about that acidity just really helps fruit pop. So I was really just kind of looking for a way to sneak into the Belgian fruit category with a little more tart beer. So a Saison is kind of the perfect base for that. And And since I sort of came up not too far down the road from Jester King in Austin, Texas with my original home brewing, so I'd been kind of inspired by a lot of those farmhouse things. So, you know, they've been playing around with a lot of like wine juice and wine must hybrid type things. So that was kind of how that all came together as far as just, you know, what ingredients to use and what style to go with. And then Gewürztraminer had actually been one of my favorite wines whenever I'd wine taste out in California. The town I lived in had 100 wineries, so I knew that had kind of a nice fruity, kind of grapefruity floral thing that I thought would work well with the pineapple and the passion fruit. But you know, we had been open for 3 months at that time, so you know, if I told you I thought we were brewing a silver medal winning beer at the time, you know, I'd have just been messing with you.
And so how did you handle the fruit, and then how did you handle the souring aspect? And you know, I would assume that temperature plays a big role in there as well.
Well, so yeah, the acidity of the grape juice is what's bringing the tartness. So we're not introducing any bacteria cultures, at least knowingly. But so far what we've done with it is we've kind of pumped the fruit in. We have what we call like kind of a yeast spring, so it's kind of just a modified 15.5 gallon keg, and we'll kind of use that for some additions like this. So we just dump all the fruit puree and the grape juice into the brink. Try to get it in towards the tail end of fermentation. You know, we will dump off a little yeast and trub. Obviously, being a saison yeast, there's still plenty in solution. But yeah, we'll be trying to get that in somewhere in the day 4 to 7 range, and then try to be on that fruit for at least 10-12 days before we crash it.
And with the saison yeast, do you play with the temperature range at all, or do you just let it have the reins?
Well, I think the interesting thing for me is I've messed around with the saison yeast quite a bit, and yeah, that Belgian, especially if it's that sort of typical DuPont Saison 1, you can let that thing get real crazy hot. The French will give you great character in the mid-60s. So especially kind of knowing we had this beer that we wanted some Saison character to peak out, but we really wanted it to be just this nice, refreshing, you know, fruit beer. We started maybe 67. We'll let it ramp to like mid-70s, just depending on how it's kind of going. But we won't take it too crazy. You know, we're not looking for... You know, originally, the other reason we started brewing that beer was just we noticed, you know, there's a large number of people in this community that really like cider, really like fruit cider. So, you know, my aim originally was just try to give them something to replace that was made here.
Hmm. And what would you say the percentage of fermentables, you know, between malt and fruit was? You know, is it how fruity is it?
Oh, let's see. We're a little bit over in a 20-barrel batch, I think we're at 14 boxes of, maybe 5 gallon boxes of fruit puree, and then 20 gallons of wine juice.
Wow. And did you, is it a challenge? Does the fruit juice dry out the beer a lot, or is there a challenge with striking a balance that way with mouthfeel?
Well, from a water perspective, I think we kind of go at it the way we go after most stuff now, whereas we keep the sulfate pretty low. You know, we'll keep it around 30 to 50 probably, and that's just what we think is coming through what our Lamotte kit says is coming through our water. And then we'll build the chloride to somewhere between 100 and 150, so that kind of helps give you a little more rounded mouthfeel, you know. So that's pretty similar to what we'll do with a hazy IPA as well. I think for whatever reason, that, I mean, that beer's like bone dry, but, you know, you'll get the every third untapped check, and we'll call it sweet, too.
Huh. So,
and I don't know if that's the wine element so much, or, yeah, like I said, those two tropical fruits really, but yeah, I mean, it's bone dry. It's probably ending at 0.994 or something.
Wow. Wow. The mind plays tricks sometimes.
It's well, and you know, for me, having people say that it's sweet, you know, we were trying to replace some beverages that that are sweet. So, you know, if it's working, if not broke, we're not going to fix it. You know?
Yeah, well,
a lot of people, the fruit character shines through so strongly that, you know, to your point, it kind of just tricks their brain and they think, well, there's this much fruit character, it's got to be sweet. So,
and I guess that's an indication that it's not astringent, you know, in any way, because if people thought it was astringent, that would accentuate their perceptions of dryness, maybe.
Oh, for sure. Well, and I mean, this is another nice thing about brewing a Saison that you know you're going to pound with fruit. Is, you know, we keep the bittering addition to like 10 or 15 IBUs and don't do any further hop additions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's definitely an advantage knowing that you're brewing a beer like Saison for the fruit, because otherwise we'd obviously shoot for more hops in the beer just for our own taste.
Yes. Speaking of hops, you won a bronze in the hybrid Belgian category for a beer named Catnip for Brewers. And I'm assuming from the name, just from the name, that there may be some hops in that one.
Yeah, that was kind of a small trial project we were doing with the Saison base. And we had kegs of that that we had to let them settle. Sort of let the hops congeal in the bottom of a Sankey keg before we could even try and pull it through. So we didn't really get a lot of complaints about customers having to floss hops out of their teeth. So appreciate that. But
I think what we ended up doing is we ended up jumping the beer at least one or two times, because the dry hopping, like Grant mentioned, kind of it took place in the keg. So we put a 6-barrel spear into a 1/2-barrel keg to allow room for the hops to fall down and hopefully not get sucked up through the spear. But so after we transferred all the beer out of those kegs into separate ones, where then there was, you know, more settling of the hop debris. So I think we ended up getting it to a place where, you know, you wouldn't have to pick stuff out of your teeth, but the occasional hop leaf still kind of snuck through.
I think we tried 4 different hop blends. We were doing like 2 pounds per 15 gallons, I think.
Wow.
2.5 pounds of hop.
Yeah.
And then I think it was Cashmere, Sabro, Strata, Citra.
I think a little Mosaic.
We had some Mosaic too. Yeah, you know, just all the really.
I think Lemon Drop.
Oh, we had some Lemon Drop too. Just all the really ho hum hops, you know.
Run of the mill.
Yeah, not real fun ones.
And were those whole or pellets?
Those were all pellets.
Oh.
Yeah, this is another. I can see that this is a running theme with us, but we don't recommend any of the things that we're talking about.
Yeah, I can see where that might cause some clogging issues if you're not careful. And
well, and yeah, on the pro level, we did kind of the trick that you would, you know, like I know guys that'll cut their dip tubes and their cornies.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of us doing that, putting a 6-barrel spear in a 1/2-barrel, because those spears are a little bit shorter.
And what was the character of the base beer that you were blending these with?
So that was actually the same Saison base as All the Goodness.
Oh, okay.
This was just kind of us playing around with, we wanted a hoppy Saison.
Yep.
We weren't going to be able to brew 20 kegs worth of hoppy Saison anytime soon. So this was very much a labor of love.
So I take it you think you'd probably get more intense hop character by dry hopping in the keg than, say, using like a Randall at serving time to push the beer through?
Some of that's just going to be about contact time, probably.
Yeah, I've done some hop Randalling before, and I would say the biggest difference between what I experienced then versus our process now was, for whatever reason, in the Randall, I feel like you pull a lot more of the hop oil that doesn't really give it time to diffuse. So you end up with like a desiccating effect on your tongue. It's like incredibly bitter and really, I don't want to say it's unpleasant, but it's definitely a different experience than just letting all of those oils kind of naturally diffuse through through a keg.
That's interesting. So it's not emulsifying, but it's just kind of blending in better.
That's my guess, anyway. I don't really have anything to back that up other than just my experience between the two.
I would think maybe you'd pick up more aroma with a Randall with a shorter contact, and you're going to get more. You're going to actually get more flavor and bitterness, maybe from a dry hop. I do know from talking to some other brewers that they've been able to find that you can add up to like 40, 45 IBUs of bitterness from just dry hop.
Yeah, there's all the hop calculators or the IBU calculators out there. They even at zero. Zero time in adding in your hops in the boil, they say zero IBUs, or at least the old calculators that I still use. And I think there is a bitterness contribution. If you were to just chew on a hop pellet, you would get some bitterness. So I think that you are adding into the bitterness equation, even, especially if you dry hop with a big bunch of stuff.
Yeah, I always have trouble nowadays when people ask us, how much IBU is something. Cause like I said, I think there's just the techniques are such now that we're, back in the day it was, you were extracting bitterness for bitter, for sort of alpha acid's sake. But now we're trying to get all these other volatile compounds and oils out. And, like I said, I remember being a home brewer and the same as you're talking about where it was like, oh, well, a 0 minute doesn't add any IBU. Hell, I'll put a whole pile of pellets in at that stage, And I started making some real crazy hop bombs as a home brewer, but it's definitely a challenge, I think, trying to convey, especially like even on the pro level, but the homebrew level too, right? How quickly do you cool it? How do you cool it? There's so many factors. If you're going to try to, one man's 20 IBU at X time is going to be another man's 20 IBU.
I've told this story many times on the show before, but I know home brewers who they go into their brewing apps or whatever, and they put in their hop additions, and they find out that the IBUs are out of spec for the style, and then they'll switch to another hop calculator, and it'll be in spec, and they'll say, okay, I'll use that one instead.
Yeah, I remember back in the day, I think I switched my Beersmith over to Rager because that was what Jamil Zanishev was using. And then that gave me a little bit better comparability to a lot of his recipes in brewing classic styles.
Let's talk about let's move away from hops to talk about another silver medal winner from the bold stout category, and I love big stouts. Perfectly Pleasant.
So that's an American stout recipe I've been kind of playing with. I definitely noticed a big shift from the last 10 barrel system I brewed on it to this one. The chocolate malt really came through a lot heavier. So it's something I'm still kind of playing around with, but because everybody's clamoring for American stout these days. that batch was fun. We had a decent bit of Mosaic, Sabro, and then there's this experimental hop from Hopsteiner, which apparently doesn't hold up very well to some sort of mites or something, so I think it's going to go away. But it's 06300, and if you get a chance to get your hands on that, it's got this really kind of cool, it's like a vanilla chocolate coconut thing, like not like Sabro, but it's a hop that is really fun in a stout, but I don't know really where else. It gets kind of weird, earthy, chocolatey. You're going to like try it at an IPA. But that was kind of a fun hop mix in there. And then, yeah, we just want to say, like some Simpsons DRC, a little Special B, a couple different types of chocolate malt. Yeah, our market in particular is definitely kind of going away from that style. Everything's kind of going pastry and chewier. But we wanted to get one win for the good guys before we started making pastry stouts.
Well, you can make a smaller batch or something, can't you?
We don't really have I'm kind of on the record of saying pilots are for planes. we pretty much either make 20 kegs of some or we don't make it at all. Notwithstanding our shenanigans with catnip for brewers, yeah.
So We found out that in your history of brewing stouts or this kind of style, how have you gone through an evolution of how many different specialty malts that you put into a recipe? I mean, you know, it seems like to me when I first started brewing stouts, and I don't have, you know, a long history of it, but you know, it seems like to me that every dark grain in the brew shop I wanted to put in the recipe. But it seems like to me that lately I've been paring back and going more simple, you know, with the grain bill. What's your evolution been on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think stout-wise, especially Imperial Stout, everybody's kind of got that. Everybody comes up sort of trained that that's the one beer you can put 14 different malts in. You know, I definitely think it's not a bad idea to sort of try to use that idea of, you know, don't get too crazy with it. But at the same time, like, there's malts that, you know, once I get a better feel for them, you know, they're like a crisp pale chocolate or a Gambrinus honey malt or, you know, whatever it may be. Like, once I feel pretty confident about the notes it's going to give us, like, I'm not that worried about overcomplicating a grain bill per se. So, yeah, this is the annoying answer of you sort of find what works for you. And I think the nice thing about being a home brewer, right, is, I mean, you could sort of fearlessly try new malts. You know, I think on our end, you know, if we're going to try out a new chocolate malt or a new crystal malt, you know, we may even kind of do it half and half of what we had in there before, just so that the migration, the flavor migration from batch to batch isn't too, you know, too much like, whoa, this is a totally different beer. But obviously, you know, obviously if you're brewing at home, I mean, you make a totally different beer every time.
Right. Right. Let's end up our round the world trip with your beers by talking about your German wheat beers, because it looks like you won Tell Your Mom I Said Hi. It looks like won you the competition basically in San Diego, and then you got a silver for Hug Deal Gone Sideways at GABF. So talk about your approach to, you know, to that style.
Well, yeah, those are two very different beers. Tell Your Mom I Said Hi was a passion fruit tart cherry goza.
Oh.
And interestingly enough, Hug Deal Gone Sideways, the first time we brewed it, we were trying to make a crystal vise. So we actually lowered the amount of wheat malt and, you know, did full-on whirl flock, and we built up the calcium level to over 100 parts per million like you would if you wanted a yeast to flocculate. And it despite all those things, came out to be a delicious, cloudy, half. So we sort of keep brewing the half like we're approaching a little bit of a crystal vice. But we do a step mash on that. We have steam jackets in our mash tun, and we do a insanely laborious, Lucas can attest to this, but it's not the most fun brew day, but I'm not sure that it isn't making the beer better. So.
Well, it the beer did turn out fantastic. The day that we brewed that beer was my second ever brew day on the system, and the beer right before that was an imperial milk stout, something crazy as well.
It was double mashed,
double mashed. So basically my first couple of brews on this system were very kind of obscure processes that did not really help me necessarily get a handle on our usual day-to-day.
And I think the brew right after that was the Goza base that, and we sour in our bright tank instead of in our kettle.
Ah.
So I had a fun onboarding of trying to juggle all these new skills that I was learning.
But yeah, as far as the half, I think the big secret is the, you know, run that yeast 62 to start it at 62, you know, let it ramp 66, 67. The gozas, I think I like to make gozas, and I think on our level, what's fun is we won't put any salt in right away, and we'll keep the coriander pretty restrained. And then that kind of allows us to sort of take that base beer wherever we want. You know, there's definitely fruits where a really nice salty goza is really nice with them. And there's fruits where it's kind of weird and disgusting, at least to my palate. So we try to keep super flexible. We get Lactobacillus plantarum from Omega Yeast in Chicago, and that has a 2 IBU intolerance, and it sours really well. So that's why we can pump it over to our bright tank, let it sour there. We don't hold up our kettle, and we're pretty confident. We don't brew many gruits or anything. So even if we somehow left a little lactobacillus behind in our bright tank, it's not going to sour anything. So it's definitely a cool lacto strain. I would recommend.
Interesting. So you don't have, there's a safety factor there.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure like any organism, we could goof around and we could probably train it to sour at higher IBUs. I think I heard the Milk the Funk guys talking about that, but I see no reason to ruin a perfectly safe lactobacillus strain.
Well, this has been fun. This is another brewery that I'm going to try to learn how to pronounce and one day visit.
Yeah, you're welcome anytime.
Yeah, you know, one of these days, hopefully, we'll be back to quote unquote normal in many ways, and I plan on making up for being stuck in my house for the past year. So, congratulations to everybody up there, and I wish you continued success.
Hey, we appreciate it. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Well, thanks again to Grant, Lucas, and Betsy. I would love to visit Hazelig in Newton, Iowa to see what other fun things they're coming up with one day. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies always coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Till then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio. I swear I haven't been drinking. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, stay well and stay tuned. Say long. I swear I haven't been drinking. So long.